You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening. I'm Al Vohner, and this is The Public Eye. During the during World War II, in fact, even to this very day, and especially if you're an art lover or historian, there have been stories, there have been documentations, there have been documentaries talking about the vast amount of artwork that was stolen by the Nazis during World War II. And much of that was taken from many of the Jewish people during World War II. And a lot of it has been found, a lot of it has been restored. Two questions come into mind. One, how did many people come to own these beautiful, rare pieces of artwork? And secondly, how did many of it, how much of the recovery and how did it take place? And we'll be talking for the next half hour with Charles Delheim, educator and author of the new book, Belonging and Betrayal, How Jews Made the Art World Modern. Charles, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here, Al. How are you doing?
It's a great time to be talking about this because I think history, and you know this better than anybody because you're an educator, so much of history, whether it's U.S. history or world history, many young people just don't get that in the schools the way you and I perhaps did. But I think this is important because we saw how during World War II, the Nazis and especially the German army were ordered to go in and steal valuable artwork. But yeah, like you say in your book, though, how many Jewish people come to own rare artworks? You would think that these rare, beautiful pieces of art would have been in museums long before, any individual was able to take possession. How did that all begin?
Well, it's a really fascinating story, and it takes place over centuries. So traditionally, art was the preserve of princes, nobles, and churchmen. And you would see art, if you were lucky, in a palace, in a villa, a country estate, or a townhouse. Or perhaps you would see it in a great cathedral where ordinary people like the rest of us could see these things. And that might well have continued, but in the later 19th century, landed aristocrats had to raise liquid capital for a variety of reasons. And one of the things that they began to sell were incredible family art collections, which wouldn't have gone on the block otherwise. So these collections go to the highest bidder, and many of the highest bidders were the American capitalist new rich, famous names like J.P. Morgan in finance, or not as well known to the general public, but someone I write a lot about, Benjamin Altman, who was a department store owner in New York, but who came from a family of Bavarian Jewish immigrants whose dad ran a not very successful dry goods store. And when he finally took over sole control, he began to build what became a flourishing business known as an enlightened employer, a lifelong bachelor. And he began to buy art. And he began fairly modestly by buying pottery, some beautiful blue and white pottery. And one of his principal dealers, in fact, his principal dealer, were the Duveens. And the Duveens were, by origin, Dutch Jews. And Joel Duveen, upon his father's death in the mid-19th century, went to England and started out as a vegetable salesman, sold to grocers. And he soon began parlaying these very modest goods into more expensive goods, including a very rare Chinese jar, which is now in the Victoria and Albert Museum. And Joel had a brother, Henry, who was a bit of a ne'er-do-well. Their mother had died young, and Henry had been sent off to a school in Amsterdam where he got into some trouble, including some romantic trouble with a distant cousin that the family wasn't happy about. So they packed Henry off to America. Started out in Boston, didn't do very well there, and ended up in New York, where he did do well. And why this is important is that the Duveens were among the people who were able to benefit from this, you know, crazy opening in the art market of these old master paintings, Raphael's, Titian's, Tintoretto's, Velazquez, Holbein, Reynolds, Gainsborough, that were suddenly for sale. And people like Altman and like J.P. Morgan, or closer to home, Isabella Stewart Gardner, had cultural ambitions. And part of it is they wanted beautiful things in their lives. And part of it was that they were attracted by the provenance or the origin of these works of art, and the fact that these works of art had been owned by dukes or earls, or in some cases, princes or kings, made them all the more valuable.
Yeah. Now, when go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry. So where do the museums come into it?
Right.
Well, museums really start out in the later 18th century, but most of them are fairly small, and they've had their origins in some cases, like the Louvre as a royal palace. But what's interesting, then, that I show in the book is that these major collectors, whether it's Isabella Stewart Gardner, or it's Henry Huntington, or it's H.C. Frick, or Benjamin Altman, put together amazing collections. And these collections, which are built with the help of the dealers that I write about, tend to end up in museums. So, as you know, once something is in a museum, it's very unlikely that it's going to be what they call deaccessioned, in other words, sold off. So these people are getting in on the act at this very fluid moment in the market.
Now, the thing that caught me, and I'm not an art dealer, but I found
neither
it.
Neither am I.
Yeah, but right. But based on all the research that you did, I bet you could do well by that now. The fact is that had the Germans, had the Nazis not removed most of these fine works of art from Europe, I mean, so much of it made its way here shortly afterwards. Would America have had any exposure outside of visiting Europe and seeing these great works? In other words, did the Germans, through their actions, kind of get this thing rolling so that these great works of art actually made their way to the U.S.?
Well, it's a really interesting question. So after the war, there was a vast recovery of the stolen works of art by these monuments, fine arts, and archives officers, who we call the monuments men. And they were art historians, curators, who ended up, like James Rorimer, one of my main characters, having really important roles in American museums. Rorimer, who came from a family of German Jewish origin in Cleveland, went to Harvard, ended up as the director of the Met, where he had to deal with a kind of undercurrent of anti-Semitism. So there is a quantity of works of art of muddied origin or provenance that become available, shall we say, after the war. And there are individuals and institutions who either turn a blind eye to where these works of art came from, or knew that there was something wrong and still went ahead and bought them. But the story of these museums in America really goes back to the later 19th and early 20th century. And if you had gone to, say, Museum of Fine Arts in Boston in 1880 or 1890, you just wouldn't have seen much. I mean, there were some original works, but they were a limited number. There were copies, and as you say, For Americans, the American tourists went to Europe, and the only people who went to Europe, obviously, at that point, were wealthy people who could afford to go on grand tours and bring back paintings, sculpture, decorative art. But what's interesting about the story I tell of belonging and betrayal is that the people I write about, the Duveens, the Gampels, the Wildensteins, are all instrumental in shaping American museums. First, because they are the ones working with these great collectors who either form their own private museums like Frick or Gardner, or like Benjamin Altman, who regarded himself as a man of the people, a person with a real democratic spirit. And when it came time for him to figure out what he was going to do with his collection, he gave it to the Metropolitan Museum. Not because he was part of that social circle, because that social circle was really Anglo-Saxon Protestant, did not have any time for Jews, but because he wanted the people of the city to have access to beautiful things. That's a large part of the story. So museum building, as we know it today, owes a lot to the dealers I write about.
Right.
Joseph Duveen, who was called the most spectacular art dealer of the 20th century, a kind of amazing deal maker, was instrumental in building the National Gallery because his collectors included people like the Mellons, and he urged them to donate their art to the National Gallery. He was also involved in the National Gallery in the United Kingdom, in the Tate Gallery in London also. So museums play a really important part in this story. These days, museums get a certain amount of criticism, some justified, some unjustified, because of where the art comes from, that it comes from other civilizations that were taken as conquest or booty. But, museums didn't appear out of nowhere. They were built by individuals who were civic-minded, who wanted to conserve art and had an educational purpose.
Right.
And this is a big part of the story I tell.
I want to just take a quick pause and pick up where you just left off. You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. My guest this week is educator and author Charles Delheim. His new book, Belonging and Betrayal, talking about how this country really was able to acquire some of the finest works of art from Europe and other parts of the world, and really build a vast network of museums and repositories for some of this great and beautiful works of art. And Charles, again, I'm not an art expert, but we're talking about Cezanne, Monet, Chagall, Picasso, just Matisse, just to name a few. And those names,
right.
I wouldn't necessarily know everything that they created, but those names are synonymous with fine art. But going back to something you said earlier, and I think most people would understand the fact that had it not been for people like the Duveens, and first and foremost, acquiring this stuff and then selling it to wealthy American industrialists or business people who then decided that perhaps putting this on display for the public would be a fine cultural move, and I get all of that, and that's a great thing. But what was there ever any effort put into, because you talked about this, how it was acquired originally, was there any effort to find the original owners or descendants of the original owners?
Well, there was, and these Jewish dealers and collectors that I write about played a critical role as champions of modern art. People like Kahnweiler as a dealer for Picasso, Bernheim's for Bonnard and Vuillard, and at some points in conjunction with another dealer for Monet. Viennese collector Heinrich Rieger, who was a dentist by profession, trained as a doctor, was the greatest collector of the works of Austrian expressionists like Schiele. Now, what it comes down to in terms of the recovery, well, it's a complicated story. The Nazis come to power, and soon after they begin this massive dispossession of Jewish-owned assets, whether it was a tailor shop or a department store, a textile factory, whether it was money, whether it was gold, works of art, furniture, musical instruments, there's this enormous, almost inconceivably large pillaging that takes place. And this takes place in Germany, and then when the Nazis, quote, annex Austria, in Austria. And then during World War II, in the spring of 1940, you know, the Wehrmacht topples one country after another on the continent, and the Nazis occupy them. And as soon as they occupy them, they begin to plunder art collections. So they come into Paris in mid-June, 1940, the fall of France, a national catastrophe. And they are armed, among other things, with a list of, say, the 15 biggest Jewish art collectors and dealers. And they raid their homes, they raid their galleries, they try to find out where they've hidden their art. And they hold on to this art, they send it to Germany. They'll hide it in salt mines, monasteries, and castles. What happens after the war or at the end of the war? Well, the monuments men, like James Rorimer, one of my characters, come along, and they hunt down this art, and it's an amazing story. But the problem is, once they've hunted down this art, what are they going to do with it? They're talking about thousands and thousands of works of fine and decorative art, including, you know, unsurpassed masterpieces. And they recover it, and it's a great adventure story. But then what happens? Well, these are people who want to get back to the States, but they also don't have much in the way of local knowledge. They don't have any way of knowing who originally owned this art. So what they do, and this is a U.S. government policy decision, is they repatriate the art to the country it came from. The Nazis were inveterate record keepers. They numbered every work of art, and without being too gruesome about it, they also numbered the arms of everyone who went to the camps, and they kept track of them. So the record showed where these works of art came from in most cases, and they'll go back to, say, Paris. Well, that was fine, but the fact that they went back to Paris was no guarantee that they would go back to, say, Paul Rosenberg or his older brother, Léonce, who were two great dealers in modern painting. Sometimes it was lack of documentation. Sometimes it was lack of communication. There were national commissions that were formed after the war to recuperate stolen art. They did a fairly good job in some countries. They did a pretty limited job in others. And there were thousands of works of art that were never returned. And again, the reasons are complicated. Part of it is administrative and managerial. If you are a Jewish refugee who's come to, say, America to start over, you can't just flit over to Paris all the time, much less to the countryside, to a provincial museum, to see if paintings that you owned are now on display. So there are logistical problems, and there's this immediate flurry of interest in the recovery of art, which fades by the end of the 1940s. And individual families continue to look as best they can. But then in the late 1990s, for a variety of reasons, there's a dramatic resurgence of interest in the recovery of Nazi stolen art. And by then, there's much better information available. And you also begin to see an effort by museums, galleries, and auction houses to try to figure out the provenance of their works of art. So just one example, there was a blockbuster show at the Museum of Fine Arts, Monet in the 20th Century, in the fall of 1997. And one of the paintings exhibited there was Claude Monet's Water Lilies, 1904. And it turned out that this painting had been stolen from a Parisian Jewish art dealer, Paul Rosenberg, who had finally made his way to New York with his family. And it had been expropriated by the German foreign minister, Joachim von Ribbentrop. And von Ribbentrop was hung for war crimes after the war. And the painting was discovered in Hamburg with his wife, who said that he had purchased it properly, which was a total lie.
Mm-hmm.
So the painting is recovered, but it goes back to Paris and then eventually to a provincial museum. And it's only around the time of the Museum of Fine Arts show that the ownership is discovered. But even then, it was murky, and the museum did not respond quickly. They consulted with the French government, and the painting wasn't returned to the Rosenberg heirs until the spring of 1998. And that is almost 6 decades after the time it was stolen.
Yeah, that's the whole sad part about all this. Charles, with the few moments that we have left, and we certainly don't want to give away the book, and it's quite a book. There's a lot of information in there. But let me ask you, in spite of the way that the artworks were acquired, in this case, the Germans just basically taking from many Jewish families who had come into possession of these great works of art early on. And then as you were talking about the 1990s, there seemed to be a resurgence of interest in fine artwork. Is it fair to say that in spite of the way that much of this artwork got here, that it is indeed the reason why we have such a prolific collection? And I don't know what Europe has, but it sounds like this country has quite, and as you said, dispersed among many different museums from coast to coast. This country, and correct me if I'm wrong, this country is now quite a repository for some of the finest, works of art in the world, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a process that really begins at the turn of the 20th century. And you see these amazing paintings from the old masters like Rembrandt's coming here. But then you also have institutions like the Museum of Modern Art in New York, which is formed in the 1930s and champions modern art. And the dealers that I write about, like Paul Rosenberg, have very close ties to this museum. And they are bringing over Picasso's, Matisse, Braque, well before the war starts, or at least a couple of years before. And then when these refugee dealers move here, if they were lucky, and this depends a lot on when they got out and how they got out, they brought works of art with them. And then there's also the works of art that came here after the war, which may or may not have belong to the people who actually acquired them.
Right.
But this country has an amazing collection of museums, not least in Boston.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. The book is Belonging and Betrayal, How Jews Made the Art World Modern, and the author has been my guest this evening, Charles Delheim. Charles, real quickly, if people want to reach out to you directly, how might they do that?
Well, they can reach me on email at delheim@bu.edu. I'm on the university website. I'm afraid I'm not a social media person at this point, so I don't have a web page.
Mm-hmm.
They can buy the book if they're interested at book.org or at the local independent bookstore. Through the University of Chicago Press. It's also available, of course, on Amazon.
Yeah. And as I said, whether you're a fanatical art expert or lover or not, it is indeed a piece of history that Charles has brought to light as to how this country acquired so much of these valuable and the rare pieces of art, which have made this country so rich in that that part of the culture of the art world here in the United States. Any questions about the broadcast, you can certainly give us a call here at the studios at WICN. Our main number is 508-752-0700. You can pose any comments, questions, or feedback to me directly. I certainly welcome that. That's Al Vona, V-U-O-N-A, at WICN.org. For the public eye, this is Al Vona. Thank you.